Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Something beautiful happens in habitats around the world every morning at daybreak. In a jungle in Southeast Asia, on a farm in southern England, and the Amazon rainforest. These are the sounds of dawn choruses, an explosion of song and call that happens at the edge of night and day, in environments at every latitude.
You have like so many different species calling at the same time, when it's dark and the sun is coming up.
These choruses are one way we experience the beautiful diversity of life all around us.
The incredibly rich tapestry that we have on Earth.
But that tapestry is wearing thin as species disappear from our planet at a very fast rate. And once a species goes extinct,
we've lost something that we can never recover.
This happens because of climate change, loss of habitat, and pollution.
I think the concern that we have about biodiversity being lost has a lot to do with how much poorer the world would be if we didn't see all the different things around us, if we only had a limited number of species.
On today's show, a look at biodiversity, the variety of life on Earth, why it matters, how it's threatened, and what people are doing to better understand and protect it. First up, the scientist credited with popularizing the term biodiversity, putting it on the map as a topic, was E.O. Ed Wilson. He died at the end of last year. He was a tireless researcher and ambassador for the natural world, and he had an impressive career that spanned almost seven decades. He started his career as a taxonomist, grouping organisms into categories. He studied ants to understand how they communicate and how their societies are organized. He explored the importance of habitat, interactions between species, and he spoke about the cascading effects of extinction. His best-selling books warned readers about humanity's toll on the planet, but also offered hopeful, if sometimes radical, ideas for preserving nature. Writer Caleb Johnson felt a special connection with E.O. Wilson over their shared roots in Alabama, and he got to visit the famous biologist in February of 2020. Caleb wanted to know how the scientist remained positive in the face of ongoing environmental challenges.
E.O. Wilson taught many decades at Harvard and traveled the globe researching ants, but, like me, was born and grew up in Alabama. In January 2020, I asked for an interview with the man some call the most influential evolutionary biologist since Darwin. I'd been revisiting his books for a novel I was working on, and his brilliance, the joy with which he writes about the natural world, reminded me why Ed was someone who always made me proud to be from Alabama. I couldn't help wondering what he'd be like in person. So, kind of on a whim, I'd reached out. Ed's assistant took some convincing. Eventually, I did wear her down. She said Ed would get in touch. And a few days later, he actually did. Of course, I missed the call.
Hi, Caleb. This is Ed Wilson calling.
Luckily, Ed left a charming voicemail. It ended with a joke about a Georgia farmer being asked why he voted for President Carter.
He's the only candidate in the election that don't speak with an accent. So I hope you won't change your accent. And in any case, I'm sure we'll get along just fine.
A month later, I arrived well after 9 p.m. on a Thursday at an active retirement community where he lived outside Boston. My flight had been delayed, and I worried that Ed, who was 90 years old at the time, might have gone to bed, or worse, grown angered by my tardiness. Instead, after a brief introduction, he walked right out the door, cane in hand, with plans for dinner at a nearby restaurant. We started getting to know each other over Japanese beer and noodles.
Well, my name is Ed Wilson, also known in the little town of Bruton as Snake Wilson. I got that sought after pseudonym because I was going around catching snakes all the time.
Most of the interview took place over the next 2 days in a sunroom filled with tropical plants and wicker furniture. Outside, snow covered the ground. Ed was energetic throughout, belying his age. He talked often of Alabama with a fondness I recognized as an adult who also left and stayed gone many years for work.
I am not a Harvard professor who was born and raised in Alabama. I'm an Alabamian who came up to North to have work.
Our conversations were filled with wistful affection, not unlike others I've had with Alabamians who move away. The difference was, this time, I was reminiscing with someone who redefined ways in which we think about everything from ants to human behavior to land conservation. The truth was, I'd reached out to Ed in search of hope, or perhaps comforting, at the start of a new decade announcing itself with the warmest January on record to that point. Smoke from wildfires in Australia could be seen from outer space, and a deadly coronavirus had begun spreading outward from China. Amid all this, my wife and I were considering having a kid. Early on, I asked about the dissonance between how we sometimes speak of the environment and how our daily actions actually impact it. What do we do about that so it's not just we're talking about how much we love and appreciate it, but we're actually tending it, you know, and investing in it?
I'm waiting for you to provide the answers.
I came to you looking for answers, Ed.
Okay.
I also wanted to know how Alabama shaped his mind and his work, and in turn, influenced global ideas about biodiversity and conservation.
There are two kinds of bragging. In the North, bragging is a way of promoting yourself in society, and in the South, bragging is the beginning of an interesting story.
Ed bragged that he spent his early years in Mobile, a port city located at the mouth of one of the most biologically diverse wetlands in the nation. He came of age as an observer of the natural world in Bruton, a small town farther inland. There, young Ed was a frequent visitor to a local goldfish hatchery owned by an Englishman and his wife.
He was the goldfish king, and he had built up a variety of snakes. He hadn't built it up, but he had allowed it to build up, that had free meals whenever they just wanted to go out and snag a goldfish.
The hatchery was fed by artesian springs that flowed down into the surrounding bottomland, creating a swampy landscape that was a budding naturalist dream. There were butterflies, turtles, and of course, plenty of snakes to earn him that nickname. He still vividly recalled an encounter with one particular reptile all those years later.
I heard a rustle as I was walking through a bunch of bushes along the streams, and I looked down, and there was a huge cottonmouth moccasin. I can't tell you how long she was, but she was heavy when I finally lifted her up. What a thrill. I had to catch her and keep her and study her.
Ed's interest in nature stemmed from his surroundings, but one reason he paid such close attention to begin with was due to his early exposure to evangelical Christianity. Not an uncommon way to grow up in the South then or now. Religion taught Ed the importance of having a moral compass and following it.
So I had that bred into me in the learning process, and I felt the responsibility to do something right that was religious in intensity.
This intensity eventually focused on ants. Some of the first ants he collected came from Alabama, but Ed also studied ants in Cuba, Mexico, and New Guinea, among other places. Rather than puzzle out how these insects might prove useful to us, Ed devoted himself to a less human-centric approach.
I felt that it was much more interesting to find out why ants rule the world. And they do, they rule the world along with humans. We could go out with a shovel right now and we can just take, I'll let you pick the spot, woods, right here, anywhere. And we all dig it together. The first organisms we're likely to see are ants.
Ed studied the geographical ranges of ants to learn how they spread and how species evolve, which led to a pioneering theory about how much biodiversity a given plot of land can support. He said breakthroughs like this sometimes come from simple curiosity.
That's what good science is all about, is discovering what we don't know and then begin the exploration. And this is hugely the case in working out and making sense of the immense fauna of insects and other animals and the flora of the plants around the world. We've only begun our exploration.
Perhaps Ed's most lasting achievements involve being a powerful communicator of big scientific ideas, like setting aside half the planet's lands and seas for wildlife to preserve what biodiversity's left. I was curious how, if given the chance now, he'd convince an Alabamian, like my father, who's a retired coal miner, to care about biodiversity and help preserve it.
I would say that let's use different language to talk about what Alabama has. It has conceivably the richest fauna and flora, different kinds of trees and other plants and animals and birds and all the other things that we love and appreciate in nature. And this is what we need to bring more gifted people and jobs and money investment.
An economic argument. Not the worst approach in a red state like our home.
Hi, you waiting for Wilson?
I am.
Okay.
On our second day, Ed and I took a car into Cambridge and visited Harvard.
We are approaching the insect department,
which houses thousands of specimens identified by him and other entomologists. Ed showed me an ant he described and named in 1950 while a graduate student at the University of Alabama. I asked how it felt to see the beginnings of his career in entomology right before his eyes.
It's a great, warm feeling, I'll tell you.
Later, we walked across the hall to his office. To get there, we passed through a room filled with bound dissertations written by former students and more photographs, drawings, and figurines of ants than I could count.
Let's see if I can get in here. Matter of getting my key.
On one wall was a world map so outdated it showed the Soviet Union's borders. On another, a sign read, Alabama, or kind of a big deal. There were pictures of Ed receiving the National Medal of Science, meeting the Emperor of Japan.
This is a friend of mine, Jim Watson, of Watson Crick.
That's right. Ed was a peer of one of the researchers who determined DNA's three-dimensional double helix shape.
He and I used to be rivals as assistant professors in the biology department at Harvard, and then we later became close friends.
The scope of Ed's life hit me then. I'm not sure there's an Alabamian born in the 20th century who was as influential and recognized in their field. Not an actor, not a politician, not even, dare I say, a football coach. Ed accomplished such notoriety because he never slowed down and rarely wasn't working. I ask about an infamous statement claiming he never took a vacation. Turned out, this wasn't quite true. Every year for 20 years, he and his wife Irene spent a month on Sanibel Island in Florida. Though Ed's idea of a vacation might differ from many of ours.
And what I did was to surf cast, and I brought in the variety of fishes, and I started making the list of surf-dwelling marine fishes. And although that was sort of like a vacation and a hobby, I was back to just doing the same old thing. But I just so enjoy going to a natural environment, you know, and discovering what's in it.
You just can't stop, can you?
I can't stop, and I can't see any reason to stop.
Eventually, we all have to stop. Back at his home, I asked Ed about the end of life. I felt nervous approaching the topic of death, despite his generosity toward my questions. To begin with, It felt a little like he was avoiding the idea his time on Earth would end.
I don't know how we should face this, except worry about how we live and not what it would be like without us.
Ed, ever the teacher, was speaking collectively.
And if you want to be deeply religious in the Baptist manner in which I was raised, well, fine. Believe. Because in believing, you're reinforced to that kind of behavior that would make the most out of your and my existence on the planet.
But I wanted to know how he felt personally.
If you want to press me on it, I don't worry about it. I know it's coming, but I just don't worry about it.
I do want to press you on when you mentioned your friends having been passed away and you being the last remaining. Do you feel any kind of responsibility or duty with your work and daily life to them?
Actually, that's a pretty good statement of the way I feel. Yeah, that's right.
E.O. Wilson died on December 26, 2021. He was 92 years old. It may sound trite to say spending a long weekend with someone changed me, but I left Ed feeling different than when I arrived. Looking back now, I see he reminded me what it means to pay attention. The satisfaction in being able to identify a plant, a bird, an insect otherwise unnoticed on the ground. Before leaving, I asked Ed if he thought it was irresponsible to have a child in this age of mass extinction and climate disaster. His answer was emphatic. Human life must go on. To drive this point home, when signing my copy of his memoir, Naturalist, Ed drew three ants. One for me, one for my wife, and one for our not yet conceived son, who's now a little more than 1 year old.
Are those ants? Ants, that's right. How many are there?
Five.
That story was reported by Caleb Johnson. He's the author of the novel Treeborn. And after many years away from home, Caleb and his family are moving to Mobile, where he'll teach creative writing at the University of South Alabama. E.O. Wilson inspired lots of people to care more deeply about the planet, to look at nature with wonder and awe. But he also influenced a whole generation of scientists. He was a rock star in that world. Stuart Pym first met Ed at a conference in 1972.
So 50 years ago, he was giving a talk, and I stood in a very long line to meet him after that.
They became friends. Stuart was inspired by Ed's thinking on biodiversity and how important it is to protect it.
It's the variety that we see within species. It's the variety of species themselves. And it's a variety of different ecosystems, if you like, habitats, if you want something a little bit less technical.
Stuart is now one of the world's leading scientists on conservation and extinctions. He says researchers started cataloging different species more than 250 years ago, giving them different names. And for some species, like mammals or birds, we have a lot of info. For others, like fungi, we have barely scratched the surface of what's out there or what used to be out there. Talk about the process. The natural process, perhaps, of species coming and going, and contrast that to where human influence is changing that process and has been changing that process.
Well, one of the things we've been able to do across the animal and plant fungi kingdoms now for a few decades is we know how fast nature creates diversity. And we can do that by, you know, grinding up little bits of tissue and looking at the DNA. And so we know how species diversify. And we can do that for a very, very large number of different kinds of species.
Stewart says it can take anywhere from 1 to 10 million years for just one new species to evolve. Take humans, for example.
We humans split from our nearest neighbors, you know, 5 or 6 million years ago. So we're pretty typical.
What is the rate for, like, something smaller, like an ant or a fly or something like that? Do they come about more quickly?
Like many scientists, I'm a Star Trek fan. And so there's that wonderful expression in the first set of Star Trek where Scotty would tell a Captain Kirk, "She canna go faster than this, Captain." So one of the things we can do is we can look at how fast species can diversify when they're really cranking out new species as fast as they can go. And that's, you know, that's about 10 new species per million years. So that's a really, really rapid growth of species. And there are not many things that do that. There are some sort of exceptional diversifications. And so we know there are some things that go fast. It's not necessarily the little guys. Some little guys go fast, some little guys go slow. But we have this sort of overall idea about how fast nature diversifies. What we do have a good idea, unfortunately, of is how fast human actions are killing them off. And that's a death rate. We can say, how fast are human actions knocking off species? It's on the order of 100 to 1,000 extinctions per million species per year. And so that's a death rate. And it's about 1,000 times faster than the rate at which nature creates new ones.
And that is something it's hard to wrap your head around, that there would be so many species that there would still be any left at that rate, right?
I mean, putting it in another way, we can look at what fraction of species are teetering on the brink. And depending on the group, it's somewhere between about 15 and 25% of all species. So, yes, we are very concerned that so many species are at risk. We are in danger of losing so many species.
When did this rate of human influence and loss of species get really terrible?
It's accelerated a lot within the last 50 years. There were species going extinct before that. The dodo is extinct. It's like many other species on islands that when European exploration began in 1500 or so, we went to different islands and there are lots of species that lived on those islands and we wiped them out. Polynesians did that across the Pacific 1500 years before that. But the rate of habitat loss is now very, very much faster than it has been in the past. You know, we have shrunk the world's tropical forests by close to 50%, and most of that has happened within the last 50 years. Habitat loss is an accelerating problem. We need to stop it. We need to be as energetic as we can to heal nature, to restore nature, reconnect nature, and help heal the wounds that we have inflicted on the planet.
Some scientists and writers have called the loss of species that is happening the sixth mass extinction. Stewart is not one of them.
I don't like that term. And the reason is we know in the geological record that there have been five cataclysmic extinctions. The most recent one was 60 million years ago, which wiped out the dinosaurs. It's very hard to compare what's happening now to what happened 60 million years ago. What we can state is the facts as I've stated them, that we are driving species to extinction 1,000 times faster than nature is creating them. And that's something we can quantify, it's something we can measure.
That's Stewart Pym. He is a conservation ecologist at Duke University.
The Commonwealth Fund supports the Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about biodiversity, why it matters, and how it's threatened. If you want to quantify the variety of life on Earth and understand which species are disappearing, a big part of the work is to document what's here. One way that's done is by creating collections of specimens that are stored in natural history museums. I remember being blown away when the director of the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. told me that they had 35,000 squirrels alone. 35,000! But this practice of collecting and cataloging has slowed down in recent decades. Alan Yu looks at why and what it means for science.
Maybe you guys have been behind scenes before.
I'm in the basement of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, the oldest natural history museum in the U.S. Curator and paleontologist Ted Deschler is showing me around.
We're in the oldest part of the academy. We're in the 1876 building.
It's dark and it smells like mothballs. I'm surrounded by tall shelves with drawers.
I'm going to open up this case here.
Ted shows me a neatly organized collection of mice from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The mothballs are everywhere to keep insects out. The mouse skins are stuffed with cotton, and each specimen has its own label that shows when it was collected.
I'm looking at 1934. Four here. I recognize these older labels from Samuel Rhodes. This is 1897. These are more than a century old and they're perfectly good shape.
There are mice from different places in the region and across time. Ted says these are important raw materials for research.
Until we have like a time machine, we're not going to be able to go back and know what the conditions were like in 1937 in Chester County, Pennsylvania.
Most of the specimens here are rodents, like mice and rats and rabbits and raccoons, because those animals are small, abundant, and easy to collect. Scientists now and in the future can use these specimens to answer questions about the animals themselves. How have they adapted or evolved over time? Scientists can also take hair, skin, DNA samples from the specimens to answer questions about the environment that would be very hard to answer otherwise. For example, there's a collection of rabbits from Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, part of a project studying the ecosystem around a nuclear power plant in the 1980s. And future scientists may have new questions and new tools to evaluate these samples. But the Academy itself no longer sends scientists out to collect new specimens of mammals.
So in this case, we haven't had active research since like World War II, believe it or not.
The museum used to add hundreds of new mammal specimens to its collection each decade. That slowed down to the double and later single digits in the 1990s. This is a trend across natural history collections in the U.S. overall. The number of mammal specimens collected each year has gone down by more than 50% since around the 1980s. A report from the National Academy of Sciences 2 years ago compared these collections to infrastructure, like air traffic control or the server rooms behind websites. They require active maintenance. Most people do not care about them when everything is going well, but find out very quickly when things go wrong. The decrease in new specimens is bad news for scientists whose work relies on these collections, like Stephanie Smith, a postdoctoral research scientist at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. She studies the spine architecture of mammals. Talking to Stephanie made me think of these natural history collections like a series of ice cores that show how the environments around these animals have changed over time.
For example, we have skeletons of mammals that go back until the early 1900s. And so if people stop collecting, because they say, oh, this museum has hundreds and hundreds of this particular type of animal, then we lose that continuity.
Having fewer or missing specimens from the past few decades would be like having a big chunk of missing data about a time when the climate is changing quickly and animals are going extinct. It's like missing a few crucial pages from a diary. But Stephanie said these specimens are important for other kinds of research too, like discovering new species in a museum cabinet.
When someone opens a new drawer and finds, we thought these were all one species of, you know, sea star, and it turns out there's seven.
Just last December, some researchers looked at an old collection of shrews, small mole-like creatures from Indonesia, to realize they had found 14 new species of shrews. Because these are whole specimens, scientists can also take samples to study animal diseases and parasites from the past, some of which can make their way to humans. So if this work is so important, why is there less of it? The first issue is funding. Someone has to pay for all those mothballs, the space, and work to maintain existing collections, not to mention collecting new samples. The National Academy report describes this work as undervalued and underfunded, often threatened with budget cuts or in some cases being scrapped altogether. For example, more than 100 collections of preserved plant specimens in the US have closed since the late 1990s. There is another issue that is not as new, but still comes up a lot: the toll these collections have on nature.
And a lot of times children will be like, do you kill the animals? And the answer is yes.
The idea often bothers kids who visit museums, but it's a topic of conversation among scientists as well. Whether getting a specimen really requires killing an animal. Stephanie and the other researchers I spoke to emphasized that there is a very strict permitting process, and scientists have to be very specific and deliberate about collecting only as many as are necessary and doing so humanely. They will not kill any endangered animals, for example. But yes, they do kill the animals. That's because there is so much data that researchers cannot capture any other way. There's no other way to, say, study the internal organs of an animal or to get an x-ray of its skeleton. Kevin Winker, curator of birds at the University of Alaska Museum of the North in Fairbanks, put it this way.
I was actually releasing most of the data every time I let a bird go with a band on its leg.
The bird flies away, and so does a lot of information. But killing an animal to add it to a collection is still a hard thing to do for scientists who study animals.
When I actively collect a bird, I feel like a little bit of my karma just got chipped away. These are wonderful animals. I justify it mentally by recognizing that when I do take a bird, I am putting it into a position to contribute for a very long time to what I understand and know to be high quality science. They are good for literally centuries.
Stephanie says when she talks to children at the museum, she describes the specimens as ambassadors.
Everything that we have in the museum is representing its species so that it can be better known and better understood and better protected.
Stephanie and Kevin and Ted and other researchers who rely on and maintain these collections say there are some solutions. Museums are working together to fill in gaps in knowledge and put their specimens online. That can be useful if one collection is missing data about a particular time. There are databases that did not exist before, like crowdsourced audio archives of birdsong. And Congress actually approved funding for a network of over 80 field sites to collect data about animals as well as their environments across the US. That started operating in the summer of 2019. Kevin Winker says ultimately, collecting this information will benefit both animals and humans.
And if we can understand the changes that we're causing to our co-occupants, we will be better managers of our own environments.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Ecologist Stuart Pym says even though things look dire at the moment, there are still solutions.
I'm the person who came up with the statistic that we're driving species to extinct 1,000 times faster than they should be going extinct. You know, I'm often asked by interviewers, you know, how do I get up in the morning? You know, if it's so bad, how do you get out of bed? And I get out of bed because there are so many things that we can do.
He says, for example, protecting parts of the planet as natural habitats is key.
Within the last 30 years, we have greatly expanded the protected areas around the world. And on land, we now protect about 17% of the land surface.
But he says we have to be more strategic in terms of where these conservation efforts are focused.
What I'm concerned about is that we need to protect the right places. It's very easy to protect very cold or very hot places that don't necessarily have a lot of species in them. But we do need to be smarter in how we protect areas. And the particular activity that I'm involved in with the nonprofit that I direct, Saving Nature, is to recognize that we've left the world in pieces, in fragments. We're little patches of habitat here and there and everywhere. And going back to Ed Wilson, Ed showed that small patches of habitat, small islands, would lose species. So when we fragment nature, even though we've left little bits of it behind, those little bits might be too small for species to survive. You do not need a PhD in biology to know that if one of those fragments has two males in it and no females, and the fragment 3 miles away has females and no males, unless you get the males and females together, you're not getting any babies. So the idea of being able to reconnect nature is very important.
Connecting habitats in ways that species can get from point A to point B to mingle and mate.
So that species have freedom to roam, roam to meet each other. You know, the reason the chicken crossed the road was to meet other chickens. We help local community groups restore nature so we can establish those connections. Conservation science is a very new science. We're still working out what we need to do. There are many, many different solutions, many different approaches, and it behooves us to try different ones. There's no one size fits all. There's no single solution. We've got to try different things. Some of them will be more effective than others. I think reconnecting nature is now proven to be one of those.
Before Stuart left, I asked him if he had the power to protect the most important places today, where would they be? He said he would focus on biodiversity hotspots.
They're where the most vulnerable species are found. They include, the Northern Andes, coastal Brazil, Madagascar, the Caribbean, islands in Southeast Asia. And what's special about them is that they have species with small geographical ranges. If you have a species that occurs, you know, across all of North America, if you destroy half the habitat, it's still there. But if you have a species that lives, you know, just on a small area of forest in Colombia, or a mountaintop in the Andes, or the coastal forests of Brazil, those species are very vulnerable because their ranges are so small. It's much easier to destroy a species with a small geographical range than one with a large one. So where these vulnerable species concentrate and run into habitat destruction, that's where extinctions concentrate.
Stuart Pym is a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. We started this episode with the late biologist E.O. Wilson, who popularized the term biodiversity. He spent his life in the field and in the classroom. He valued scientific discovery and training the next generation of scientists. And he thought that scientists should be as diverse as the flora and fauna they study. Some of this vision is coming alive at Alabama A&M University, a historically black college in Huntsville. Researchers are training students and recent graduates in forestry and ecology research by giving them opportunities to work in the field. We caught up with four students who participated in this program.
My name is Christopher Holden. I am from Huntsville, Alabama. I am currently a forestry major at Alabama A&M University.
A major he didn't know existed, but once he stumbled on it...
And it was perfect for me, and I've loved it ever since.
Also, Zane Green from North Alabama, a recent biology grad.
I've had an interest in nature all of my life. I grew up hunting with my dad and going out and hiking.
And...
Evan Tenorio. I'm currently in Mobile, Alabama. Environmental science is pretty much what I studied all throughout college.
We also heard from Olivia Amos, a recent graduate.
My major was biological sciences with a focus in wildlife conservation.
The four of them were part of the Paint Rock Forest Dynamics Project. It's a long-term study collecting data on a temperate forest in northern Alabama. It tracks how this forest changes over time. So Christopher, Zane, Evan, and Olivia told us about their time in the field and how it affected their thinking about future careers in science and conservation.
As a field tech there, we were kind of the grunt workers.
We would show up at this parking lot in the middle of nowhere in the mountains. We would drive this UTV up the mountain with all of our stuff in it. We would walk out into the woods and find where we were supposed to be.
We had what we called quadrants, which were these 20 by 20 meter little squares on this grid of a forest plot that we had. We will go out there and measure every tree over 1 centimeter in diameter at breast height.
To put that in perspective, any tree that is as big as your pinky around will get a tag. So as you can imagine, within the plot, that is a lot of trees. And I actually did the math at one point. I was a part of cataloging about 28,000 trees.
There's not a lot of data on the forest life cycle. And with the project, it's... basically, you're having a census for every tree that's out there in that forest.
The data can be used for multiple things. It can be used to look at carbon sequestration. It can be used to just monitor how ecosystems evolve. You can see how the structure of the forest is changing, see what species are living and dying, what is being successful in certain areas.
It was very tedious. Like, it was some days you were out there sweating, mosquitoes and ticks on you, but at the end of the day, I'd rather be doing that than have a office job somewhere.
I definitely have a hatred towards specific plants because they're very annoying to measure. There's this plant called spicebush, Lindera benzoin. The reason it's so annoying is because it grows like maybe 3 or 4 feet high and it bends over. And it grows like at least 4 different stems that you have to measure. You have to get down on the ground and there's branches in your face. Some of the quads would have 100 of these in them.
Out at Paint Rock, the forest is untouched. It's only for science purposes. So everything is very natural. There's a lot of biodiversity. We saw a rare Asian snail. We also hiked up to a couple of different caves.
One of the first days I was there, we were eating lunch, and this snake, this black racer, it slithers up and snatches a frog, and it kind of sad, but you could hear the frog still doing its alarm call inside the snake. It just ate it whole.
This job really changed my life. It sounds cheesy, but it really did. It really opened my eyes to the idea of working outside and collecting data.
It made me realize that there were jobs in environmental science that were enjoyable. Like, it didn't have to be, oh, you go somewhere just to make money to get by. It was things that you could go out. And if you looked hard enough, you could possibly find your passion.
I definitely want to continue to work in biology. Prior to this job, I I was a lawn maintenance worker. I just cut grass. After being in this, it's just the little things, like seeing a snake, and like one person will see a snake and will yell snake, and the crazy people that we all work with, all of us, run towards the snake. Part of it is the kinship of other people who love what you love.
I do want to do a lot of research. I want to get more into how we can better understand our forces so we can produce healthier forces. And also when we have catastrophic disturbances like large wildfires or extreme wind damage from tornadoes or just severe thunderstorms, I do want to go into research that allows us to better help our forests bounce back. That is one of my dreams. I think the unique perspective that I have to offer in a field such as forestry is that I like having uncomfortable conversations about what needs to change and what needs to go on. As a Black student, I don't often, even in my own forestry classes, I don't see a lot of minorities. Sometimes I'm like, I'm the only Black person in my class. And I go to an HBCU. I would like to see that change. It's because it's been such a closed off space for so long. When I tell people in my community what my major is, a lot of them do not have any clue of what I'm talking about at all. We need to push people to gravitate more to our field. We need to show people what we can do and show them the opportunities that they haven't necessarily been presented.
I hope more people are able to experience things like this. I think it's important, especially for our generation and for the next generations, to be involved in nature and to actually experience it and fall in love with it. Because that's one of the things that's so hard about, you know, conservation, is getting people to care, because they don't see, they don't experience the importance and the beauty of it.
That was Zane Green, Christopher Holden, Evan Tenorio, and Olivia Amos talking about forest research led by Alabama A&M University. Irina Zhurov produced this piece.
I see trees of green.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.